How would I define what scale was? How would I explain scale? That's a really good question. I'm unprepared for that.
The Oxford Sparks Podcast, Episode 2, Matters of Scale.
My name is Pedro Ferreira. I'm Professor of Astrophysics here at the University of Oxford.
I'm Dr. Alan Barr of the University of Oxford.
I'm a theoretical cosmologist.
I'm a particle physicist.
That means that I work on the origin, evolution, and state of the universe.
And I work on the ATLAS experiment at the Large Hadron Collider. Scale is just how big or small things are. So it's just a measure of the size of an object at a sort of very rough level.
For me, scale really means length.
So whether it's about a meter long or about 100 meters long or about 500,000 kilometers long.
It also means at different energies or different weights. But really, for me, the way to think about it is at different lengths.
You know, it's a rough order of magnitude, if you like, estimate of the size of something. That's what we mean by scale. Well, I'm concerned in a wide range of scales. I'm most directly interested in the smallest things that we can measure. So that's the fundamental constituents of the universe. And that's measuring things down to length scales, which are, well, extremely small. And I think I can only really tell you how small they are in terms of scientific notation. So we're talking about 10 to the minus 18 or 10 to the minus 19 of a meter, that sort of length scale.
So the mother of all scales is the scale of the visible universe. Okay, and that is 3,000 million parsecs, right? So let me deconstruct that. A parsec is about 3 light years. A light year is the distance that light travels in a year. So you can imagine that that's a lot. Our galaxy is about 40,000 light years, 60,000 light years, which means that it's like 20,000 parsecs. The scale of the universe, 9 billion light years. So that's the mother of all scales. And we kind of compare everything against that.
The Planck length is the size at which the effects of gravity get strong. Gravity is a really weak force at normal lengths, at normal scales, whereas as you get smaller and smaller and smaller, it will have a larger relative effect. Right? At these length scales, space and time might not be continuous. There might be all sorts of bubbling going on. It's really the limit at which our current models of physics we know would break down. So it's potentially the smallest scale one might be able to access. It might even be the smallest scale, the smallest length it's meaningful to talk about.
The largest objects in the universe seem to get bigger and bigger, the bigger we make our surveys. One thing you do to look for big things is point a telescope or telescopes at the night sky and, for example, count light, measure light, look for stars or look for galaxies, and then map them out. And what you see is you see this cosmic web of structure. It's like a messed up honeycomb is one way of thinking about it. And that honeycomb will have holes and it'll have walls. And you can look at the size of what are the largest holes and the largest walls. And I would say that the largest structures are about 100 million light years.
And what are these structures?
Like voids, massive holes in the distribution of galaxies.
So is that actually something, or is that just kind of space?
It's just space, but it has an identity. You can point at that and say, look, there's this massive hole there. There's this object, which in principle it should be filled out with stuff. Everything should look pretty smooth, but it isn't. And so the fact that you identify this feature, you can say that's a thing, it's a void.
I suppose you could say that machines like the Large Hadron Collider at CERN are really the world's most powerful microscopes, and what we're doing with them is to investigate the very smallest things that we can find. We are looking much smaller than an atom. So if you look 100,000 times smaller than the size of an atom, you see the nucleus. But that's the science of 100 years ago. We're trying to look very much smaller than that again. So we're trying to look 10,000 times smaller or 100,000 times smaller than the size of the nucleus of the atom. And at that level, as far as we can tell, the particles that make up the nucleus, which are called quarks, seem to be point-like, which means they have no size whatsoever. The electrons which go around the nucleus of the atom, those seem to be point-like as well. As far as we can tell, with the technology we've got, and with our very powerful machines, these weird fundamental particles seem to have no special extent, no size whatsoever. People might wonder, how can it be that these particles exist if they have no size at all? I don't think I've got any good answer to that question, other than that that's the way that nature seems to work.
On the very large scales, there seems to be compelling evidence that there is this thing called dark matter that clumps. It's different from dark energy. Dark matter clumps around galaxies and helps to keep them together. We have no idea what that dark matter is, and there's speculation that it's in the form of particles, but we haven't been able to detect them. At the LHC, they study particles. They collide things together and they see what they produce. And the hope, the wish, is that at some point in one of these collisions, we'll be able to see one of these dark matter particles.
No one has ever smashed together protons at these energies before. No one knows what it is that we might be able to observe there. And so we're exploring new territory. Well, if there is a dark matter particle, and it seems to be from what the astronomers are telling us, that it's much more of it around than there is of normal everyday stuff that we can see, well then we ought to be able to produce that as well. So provided that this dark matter stuff is made out of particles, then the energy of the Large Hadron Collider should be convertible into mass of those dark matter particles as well. And we might hope that we would be able to, well, not quite detect them, because we wouldn't see them directly, but they might portray their presence through their absence, in fact, through recoiling against other things that we could see, even though we can't see them directly.
And it'd be wonderful, because it would mean that from the LHC we would find what are the building blocks, the fundamental particles that make up the dark matter that keeps galaxies together. So I think it really goes two ways. The people working in cosmology are saying to the particle physicists, look, you know, if such a particle exists, and it's one possibility, you might be able to find it in the LHC. And if the LHC find it, they would go back to the cosmologist and say, look, here's your particle.
Well, this is one of the problems with the research we do, is the problem of scales. So things that are on a very small scale, if they're moving, are not necessarily easy to see.
Does biology have a problem of scale?
Now, you can record some of that. There's lots of dynamical things, measurements, so you can measure actually how things move. And there's structural measurements that tell you about the structure of things, but it's a very difficult area to look at, especially in water. My name is Sylvia McLean, and I'm interested in looking at the structure of biological molecules in solution and how that relates to biochemical function.
Life is messy. It's always moving, always in flux, and unfortunately for biologists, it doesn't exactly hold still for them to take a picture, which means interrogating nature as it really exists is hard. To really understand how nature works, to get down into the nitty-gritty of life, we need to understand the fundamental principles of biology.
Biology is a huge subject. I mean, this is one of the problems, right? So if you go just look up biology at the Oxford English Dictionary or biology on Google, and it'll tell you, you know, all of the massive number of things it relates to. So sort of biology of the Chesapeake Bay. Okay, so that's about ecosystems, really. It's about fish and how they interact with water and interact with the food they eat and sunlight and all these kind of big things. But biology also scales all the way back down to atomic level things, which is actually where I would think most of the magic happens. So scale in terms of research is huge.
Knowing how biology works on different scales is important. But when we consider biology at the largest scales, looking at behavior or physiology or ecosystems, what we're looking at is the end result of many, many different biochemical reactions, each of which occurs at a very small scale. Everything from DNA replication to cellular communication. These things all happen at the atomic level.
So things like protein folding, drug-ligand interactions, water hydration on a very, very tiny scale. In solution, so it's important, instead of looking at things that are stuck in one kind of manifold, like a crystal structure, should we actually look at things as a liquid? So we look at direct hydrogen bonding from water to biological molecules.
Now this is important. Often to look at the structure of a biological molecule, like a protein or something, you need to use a technique called X-ray crystallography. Because the molecular structure is smaller than the wavelength of visible light, you need to use something with a smaller wavelength again, something like X-rays. But the only way to do this is to transform, to fix your protein into an ordered crystal structure. And then you can shine high-intensity X-rays at that and measure what comes out. But that means taking the protein out of its natural environment and fixing it into that crystal structure. It's a false environment, but it's the best we can do. And like most experimental fields in science, we've got to rely on the measurements we can make so that we can infer back what's happening in nature.
Most sort of structural studies, so people that understand the structural things, are either done on molecules in the gas phase or done on molecules in the solid state, just because they're easier to actually measure. But liquid is where most of life happens, right? So most of your body is 70% water. Or something like that, 60 to 70. Our whole planet functions in water. So the only way that proteins in your body work, for instance, is with water around. Okay, so that's why it's the most fundamental physical milieu of life. It's also the most difficult to understand because it moves. So it's not a static structure you can look at, it's actually a moving thing. So looking at things as they occur in water is not trivial. It's very, very, very difficult because most of them occur either too rapidly to measure or very, very, very slowly. So what we end up having to do is to control these things so that we can measure them as they're happening. But then that's still a false environment, right? This is a fundamental problem with most research, right? Is that we do measure model systems. When people look at cancer and try to look at cancer agents and how they might affect different things, we look at cancer cells. We rarely treat whole people with cancer, right? So it's very difficult to actually map all this stuff together. So the fundament of what we do is we do something called neutron scattering.
Slightly different from using X-rays. This time we're firing neutrons at the sample and measuring what comes out.
Okay, so a neutron is part of one of the particles that actually makes up a nucleus of an atom. Neutron scattering are things on liquids. And the nice thing about scattering techniques, which were invented by the Braggs, is that you can actually look at things on the atomic scale, and it's a direct structural technique. And what that means is that you're actually directly probing the structure instead of trying to infer the structure from something else.
So why are the neutrons so useful? Well, with any liquid, you need a holding container, and the neutrons are small enough that they pass through the container, probing the structure of the liquid that we're interested in.
So you have to have something that can get in there and probe the structure. Okay, now the way that it works is it works by you have these free neutrons. They go in and they strike the atomic nuclei of the whatever sample you have. So say you're measuring just pure water. Okay, you have a neutron, it comes in, it hits the nuclei of the oxygen or the hydrogen atom and it bounces off, okay? So it's a bit like dropping a pebble in a pond. You go and drop a pebble in a pond and you get big waves coming out. So imagine then that you drop two pebbles in a pond simultaneously. And if you've ever done that, you'll notice that the waves either constructively or destructively interfere. Which all that means is they get bigger or they have peaks and valleys and peaks and troughs. And that's what you get, that's what you're actually looking at in a diffraction pattern. So that's what neutrons can tell you. But what that also tells you is it tells you about the distances between different atoms.
So we have ways of probing the lower scales of biology, but we do still come up against this problem of scale. How do we marry up all of these very small measurements with a larger, messier biological system, something like a walrus or a human?
Well, if you can understand the fundamental principles behind why things bind together and why things, for instance, are hydrated by water in a certain way. So think of a protein, okay? And a protein's a very big object, but proteins do all the work in your body pretty much. And then you're trying to wonder how a small chemical might actually fit into that protein in order to make it do something, okay? And that something could be sending signals between cells. That something could be you eat carbohydrates and those have to be broken down in some manner to give glucose to your body, right? So the food you eat has to be processed by the proteins in your body to do something. But it also actually happens on an atomic scale. Okay, so the actual breaking of bonds is what all the energy in your body is provided by the breaking of chemical bonds. All right, so if you understand the fundamentals of that, you can start understanding things like, how do I make better drugs, right? I want a drug that I know needs to fit into this specific protein. How do I actually design that? Wait a minute, I actually know what it's going to do when I put it in the human body. I know what it's going to do if I put it in water, so that it has a link in terms of that. It's also sort of the fundamental physics of life.
One of the most pertinent questions related to the physics of life is concerned with proteins. Specifically, how do they fold?
Pass. Nobody knows that. I mean, for different systems, there's lots of theories about what regulates it, but nobody actually knows.
Don't you think that's interesting? Proteins are essential for life, and their entire function is derived from their structure and the way they fold up, and yet we still don't actually understand how that structure forms. We don't understand how they go from being a linear chain to a complex and yet still ordered structure that's conserved wherever you find them, even across different species.
It's very difficult to look at a protein folding. It happens very quickly. It happens in your body where you can't see it do that. So we have to use lots of model systems to try to probe that folding process. We just know it's not random. It can't be random, right? And the reason why it can't be random is because if you sat on a piece of paper and you drew out a really long chain of amino acids and then tried to calculate why it would fold into this, it's got lots of theoretical ways it can fold, right? But it doesn't. They tend to fold over and over and over in the same manner. And why that happens and how that occurs is completely it's not really, there's a lot of theories about why we think it occurs, but nobody actually knows how it occurs. So it's not really clear exactly the how and why they do that. You can test sort of if I boil my, it's like an egg, right? If you take an egg and boil it, it turns into a different structure because you completely denature the proteins in the egg. So on a macromolecular scale, you can see that happen. On the atomic level of detail, you can't.
You know, physicists are out there worrying about particles, looking for neatly packaged theories of everything. But here, biologists have got a lot of ground to cover, just in terms of understanding what's happening down at the fundamental scales of life. And that's exciting. It means there's the potential for a lot of big discoveries still to be made.
I mean, the fascinating thing about biology is that there's no kind of fundamental theory of biology. I think about before there was a periodic table. And basically, people were running around isolating this chemical, isolating that chemical, doing all this amazing stuff, but they had no pattern. There was no method behind this madness, and they had to actually sit down and work that out. And biology is sort of still in that stage where we're actually trying to work things out. There's no fundamental underlying theory of biology. But it's a very, very complicated system. It's a very complex system. So it's actually a problem of complexity more than it is anything else.
So will one day biology have its own fundamental, complete theory of everything? Who knows? But until then, we can have a lot of fun using the knowledge we've got about the ways in which nature works at the atomic level to understand us as living organisms, to work out how our bodies work, and maybe even one day, how and why they break. Scientists such as Sylvia span multiple scientific disciplines, pulling in ideas from physics, from chemistry, and from biology. And it's when we bring these disparate fields together that really cool things happen, especially right now in the context of nanoscience.
So normally what I say to the people is like, you close your eyes.
So go on, close your eyes.
And you think that you imagine 1 meter.
Okay.
And then you try to divide that meter in 1 billion parts.
Struggling a little?
You may not be able to do it, but suddenly you came across how small it is. So one of these billion parts is a nanometer.
You've probably heard of this thing called nano, and it's pretty small.
Extremely small.
And that word, nano, has been bundled up with a whole range of other words. Nanoscience, nanotechnology, nanomedicine. But let's get a better idea of what lies at the nano level.
For instance, an atom is below a nanometer, is 0.1. A virus is around 100 nanometers. You can visualize with an optical microscope something as more like a bacteria. But if you want to go down on the size, where you have viruses, proteins, molecules such medicines, or DNA, RNA, everything that is smaller than a bacteria cell, then you need the nanotechnology approach. And that's one nano, very, very small.
Very small.
Very small. And this is one of the labs.
So this is Sonia Trigueros.
My name is Sonia Trigueros.
She's a molecular biologist by trade, but she's wound up in the physics department at Oxford, where she set up a cross-disciplinary lab.
Biological physics lab. I use physics to understand bio, but the samples that I have are biological relevant, are alive.
A biologist? Interested in physics and nanotechnology? That sounds pretty unusual. But when we consider what exists at the nano level,
viruses, proteins, DNA, RNA,
we can begin to understand why a molecular biologist might be dipping her toes into the world of physics, trying to understand how nanomaterials might be used in fields such as medicine.
For me, is that I have my background in bio, and I have some questions. And you reach a point that you may need to other methodology to understand your questions. You can visualize molecules such, for instance, antibiotics that you take. You can see them, and it's like, wow. But then the nanotechnology is not only visualizing small things and understanding. Nanotechnology has the power of you can make small things. And that's probably the most powerful of the nanotechnology, to build structures that are very small.
So building things at this scale is interesting because materials can take on all sorts of new characteristics.
But at the nano level, it's the electronic, the quantum behavior, which rules the function, something that you will never see it in a big mass or even an atomic level. Some things can be explosive, like aluminium, copper. You know? When you imagine wire made with copper, the first thing that you think is like flexibility. At the nano level, the copper is harder than diamond.
And this opens up new possibilities with nanomaterials.
Coming from the background of molecular biologists, my case has been on nanobiology, nanomedicine. A lot of the applications right now are using nano as a drug delivery systems. So let me tell you this. Imagine that you have a headache and you take paracetamol. You take one pill of 500 milligrams, but probably only 10 will actually go to your head and stop the pain. So you have part of the paracetamol is wasted on your body, is degraded, is basically the therapeutic dose is very high. So a drug delivery system in nano is to use very small structures and put the drugs, imagine the paracetamol, on top of the or inside. The medicine in this case is protected. So it doesn't go all the way on your body, it's not degraded. Just by itself, you reduce a lot the therapeutic dose that you need. But think about the chemotherapy drugs. Right now we are having a problem. Chemotherapy drugs, we need to use lots of therapeutic dose, really high, combining both of them, or three different types, giving shots to people very sick. And the chemotherapy drugs goes everywhere in the body, like paracetamol, and affects a lot. Every single cell in your body that is alive. So that's why you lose your hair or you lose your nails, and that's why your immune system, it gets totally damaged. But it's very painful, and a lot of people get complicated infections later on. So just only putting the chemotherapy drugs on these nanostructures, you will reduce the dose that the person will need. And that's part of my project.
But using nanostructures to protect your cancer drugs is only solving one part of the problem.
The one thing I want is to be able to target cancer cells only. Cancer cell has a lot of different properties than normal cells. So we're using these properties to target and take this little nanostructure with the chemotherapy drug on top of it or inside and use these properties of cancer cells to delivery. So basically reducing the chemotherapy secondary effects. That will be the goal of my project. not doing experiments, so you're very lucky. Just a step here. Okay, this is a sticky map. Basically, you step on it, so all the dust on your shoes gets here, trapped, so you don't bring that. You put this kind of blue shoe covers with you on your shoes. It's a white lab, very white, a special material on the wall, so I can clean them very often. The floor is electrostatically charged, so all the dust goes on the floor. Nothing goes on your samples, so you have to clean the floor very often, unfortunately, but this is the only way to control dust.
So how dangerous is dust to a nanoscientist?
Well, dust is dangerous because of the size, but is worse is the bacteria and virus that people bring and you don't notice. Especially now it's okay, but on spring, when you have all this pollen, oh, that's very bad. On the biohazard, you have to protect yourself because you have chemicals that are very corrosive, very toxic. In here, you have to think that you are the toxic. And it's very expensive. If you think about it, one experiment could cost you £2,000 per day. You're not going to contaminate in the middle of the experiment, you know? You have to be very careful. A drug delivery system has to target only the cells that you want. My drug delivery system is based on carbon, so that's the one that I'm using. First of all, because it's quite stable, and second, carbon atoms, we are 180% of our body are carbon, so it's not toxic for human beings. So I found a size and a shape of a carbon nanotube, which is a graphene that you fold it, basically. And because they're very thin and very long, so I have a lot of surface. So I can actually add, already have two different chemo drugs on top of it. I make them soluble, and I think that it's the best candidate to be a drug delivery. These are the carbon nanotubes. You don't see it because obviously they're nano. So I pick up one sample, it's a small tube. The liquid is gray, which is water and nanotubes. So the color of the water has changed by the presence of nanostructures. And each of them comes from different experiments. And now the next step is to see how they interact with human cells. If one of these guys work, it will be the drug delivery system. If I can make something that allowed people with cancer have a better life, I'm up to that. I'm tired of this disease. And I believe that we will have it for always with us. Okay, I think that cancer will soon be considered as a chronic disease, unfortunately. I mean, I'm a very curious person, and everything that you touch in the nano is new. And you're like, okay. At the beginning, you get tired, but then you think like, oh, that's interesting. And you start asking people questions, meeting people, helping you on these new properties. But probably, it will take probably 10 to 20 years to see the breakthroughs, basically.
You've been listening to the Oxford Sparks podcast, narrated by me, Chris Lintott, and produced by Ed Prosser. You can find a full list of credits and much else besides on our website at oxfordsparks.net.